Philippians 1. If you are new, welcome. We are on a trek through Paul's letter to the church in Philippi. And we left off last week in chapter 1, verse 11. Let's pick up in chapter 1, verse 12. Here we go. Now, I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that what has happened to me has actually served to advance the royal announcement that Jesus is Lord. As a result, it has become clear throughout the whole palace guard and to everyone else that I am in chains for the king. And because of my chains, most of the brothers and sisters have become confident in the Lord and dare all the more to proclaim the royal announcement without fear. Yeah, it's true that some preach Christ out of envy and rivalry, but others out of goodwill. The latter do so out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former preach the king out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, supposing that they can stir up trouble for me while I am in chains. But what does it matter? The important thing is that in every way, whether from false motives or true, the king is preached, and because of this, I rejoice. This guy Paul's in prison as an enemy of the state because he goes around and tells people on the streets of the empire that Jesus is Kyrios or Lord as opposed to Caesar. And that lands Paul in jail. Now, Paul's friends in Philippi are worried about Paul. Is he okay? Is he in good spirits? Is he alive, for that matter? And the Philippians send Epaphroditus 800 plus miles from Philippi to Rome to check in on Paul. Epaphroditus shows up with cash to buy Paul food and water and clothes and shows up, you can bet, with questions. Paul, how are you? Are you doing okay? And Paul sends Epaphroditus back with a letter, also known as Philippians, and says, listen, thank you for the cash. You saved my life, friends, and I'm just fine. In fact, Paul says, what has happened to me has actually served to advance the gospel. Now that sparks a question. What has happened to Paul? With your finger right here in Philippians 1, turn to the left in your Bibles to 1 Corinthians 4. To the left, and really fast, let's read Paul's autobiography. A bunch of you have been around the Bible for a long time. And you know Paul's story. I mean, I say sword drill, and boom, you are ready to go. A bunch of you have no clue what a sword drill is, and the scriptures are all brand new. Wherever you are at in the spectrum, don't worry about that, but let's plug in for a few minutes and pick up on Paul's story and make a list of what all, and I quote, happened to Paul. 1 Corinthians 4, let's pick up in 9. 4, Paul says, it seems to me that God has put us apostles on display at the end of the procession, like those condemned to die in the arena. We have been made a spectacle to the whole universe, to angels as well as human beings. And the imagery there is of captives after war, dragged into town as gladiators, right? We are fools for the king, but you are so wise in the king. We are weak, but you are strong. You are honored. We are dishonored. It's an honor-shame society. To this very hour, we go hungry and thirsty. We are in rags. We are brutally treated. We are homeless. We work hard with our own hands. When we are cursed, we bless. When we are persecuted, we endure it. When we are slandered, we answer kindly. We have become the scum of the earth, the garbage of the world. Right up to this moment. Here's the list. On display, condemned to die, spectacle, fools for Christ, weak, dishonored, hungry, thirsty, in rags, brutally treated, homeless, on and on. I mean, the garbage of the world. Does that sound like an easy life to you? No, not at all. Turn over to 2 Corinthians chapter 6, a few pages to the right. Paul goes on. 2 Corinthians 6, let's pick up in 4. As servants of God, he writes, We commend ourselves in every way in great endurance and troubles, in hardships and distresses, in beatings. Think of Philippi, Paul stripped naked in front of the city, beat to a pulp. Imprisonments, notice plural, right? And riots and hard work, sleepless nights and hunger. Impurity, understanding, patience and kindness and the Holy Spirit and in sincere love. In truthful speech and in the power of God with weapons of righteousness in the right hand and in the left, right? Because he's in a war, he's in a conflict. Through glory and dishonor, bad report and good report, genuine, yet regarded as impostors, known, yet regarded as unknown, dying, and yet we live on, beaten, and yet not killed, sorrowful, yet always rejoicing, poor, yet making many rich, having nothing, yet possessing everything. Here's the list. Troubles, hardships, distresses, beatings, imprisonments, riots, hard work, sleepless nights, hunger, dishonor, bad, on and on. I think if Paul wrote a book, it would be called Your Worst Life Now. Right? I mean, talk about a hard, rough around the edges story. Now, with that in the back of your head, turn back to Philippians. Paul says, you know, what has happened to me, all that, troubles, hardships, distresses. And then, to top it all off, after all that, Paul lands where? In prison. I mean, the dude is shut up in prison. He's an apostle. The calling of God on Paul's life is to travel all over the empire and preach, make it loud and clear to everybody that Jesus is Lord, and the dude is shut up in a cell. I mean, that's the athlete with a broken leg on the bench, right? I mean, it's not right. You can bet Paul's torn up on the inside. All that happened to Paul, then lands in prison. Now, you would think out of that, Paul would say, gosh, that has shut down the gospel once and for all. I'm out. I'm in prison. It's over. But actually, Paul says, in fact, the exact opposite happened. Actually, all that has served to advance the gospel. That word advance in Greek is prokope. Can you say prokope? Right. And it's a vivid word picture in Greek of the Roman army out on a march and the engineers out in front of the army who paved the way, who cut back trees and cut back brush and made a road to advance the army. Paul said all that, it served to advance and paved the way for the gospel. And Paul lays out two examples of that reality. First off, 13, as a result, Paul says, it has become clear throughout the whole palace guard and to everyone else that I am in chains for the king. Now, that phrase, the palace guard, is praetorium in Greek. And the praetorium were a group of soldiers in Rome made up of 9 cohorts, or 9,000 men, who were Caesar's elite bodyguards with all kinds of power. Don't think, you know, prison guards per se. Historians speculate the Praetorium were the ones who were responsible for the assassination of Caligula and who put Claudius on the throne, regime change. You're dealing with high-powered soldiers in the empire. And Paul says, you know what? The whole palace, everybody knows I'm here. I'm here for the king, right? We think guards are on a 4-hour rotation with Paul, in chains, right, in prison, and every 4 hours, a new guard shows up, cycles through in the rotation. Hey, you Paul? Yeah, I keep hearing about you. Okay, what are you in for? Are you in for violence or murder or tax evasion, or you lead an insurrection? I mean, what? I mean, you're in, what are you in for? Paul says, well, you know what? Actually, none of that. Actually, I believe that Jesus is the king of the universe, not Caesar. You know, your whole empire, army, Caesar propaganda, you know, that slogan, Caesar is Lord, blah, blah, blah. I don't buy it. I think it's a scam. I think the whole deal is nonsense. I think Nero, God bless him, I pray for him, I pay my taxes. I don't make any money, but I pay my taxes. But you know, I think Nero is a power-hungry tyrant, and I think Jesus is the life-giving savior of the universe. And, you know, in fact, I'm working on a letter to my friends in Philippi right now, and it's going to be epic. I think they're going to read it for at least a few months. And there's this one spot where in chapter 2 I break down into poetry, and dude, it's epic, spoken word, first century style. And there's a spot, you want to hear part? Here's how it goes. Therefore, God exalted him, Jesus, to the highest place, gave him the name that is above every name, Nero, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus the King is Lord. Woo! And the guard goes, that's why you're in prison. Not for a crime per se. No, that's dangerous. That's treason. If that gets out, that will be the end of the Roman Empire, which by the way, happened. If that gets loose on that is a viral, dangerous idea. If that gets loose, it will take down Caesar. I mean, that. Let's shut you up in prison. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, the talk in the halls of the Praetorium. Did you hear about that guy in cell block A? Did you hear about that Paul? Did you hear about that Evangelion, that gospel, and how he thinks? You remember that Jewish prophet we crucified everybody was talking about? Remember that a few decades ago, that Jesus we crucified? He claims that Jesus is back from the dead and that Jesus appeared to hundreds of his followers. And you know, it's not just Paul. There's a whole movement of Paul's called Disciples of Jesus all over the empire. And it's crazy. It started with Jews in Jerusalem and that made sense, but now it's spread all over. It's Jews and Gentiles and men and women and rich and poor and slaves. It's crazy. And they all believe Jesus is Lord. And nobody will worship Caesar. Nobody will make sacrifices to the God. Everybody says Jesus is Lord, but Caesar doesn't know how to stomp out the movement because they won't fight back. They won't take up arms. They think you should love your enemies. It's a crazy upside. Did you hear about that guy? Dude, I'm on rotation with him next Thursday. I can't wait, right? And the word gets out. Now, the point is, the empire's agenda was to shut Paul up. Did that work? No, absolutely. In fact, the exact opposite happened. Paul says, everybody, all 9,000 people, everybody knows the word is out. I am in chains for the king. Secondly, 14, and because of my chains, most of the brothers and sisters have become confident in the Kyrios, or Lord, and dare all the more to proclaim the gospel without fear. By brothers and sisters, we think Paul means the followers of Jesus in Rome. Now, if Paul's in Rome, which we don't know for sure, but we think Paul's in Rome, that puts Philippians right around 61 or 62 AD. Now, Rome in the early 60s was a dangerous, volatile place to be. Historians speculate right about then, Caesar Nero, in power at the time, started to go insane. A few years later, Nero set fire to the city of Rome and in the aftermath blamed the church, and in doing so unleashed an empire-wide persecution of followers of Jesus who died by the millions for the gospel. And point being, if you live in Rome in 61, 62 AD, dude, you are scared. Because to stand up on the street or talk to your friends, your coworkers, your family, your roommates about the gospel or the royal announcement that Caesar is passing away and the kingdom of God is crashing in and Jesus rules and Jesus reigns, to talk to your friends about the gospel was to risk prison at best and death at worst. But what happens is the brothers and sisters see Paul in prison, beat up, torn, I mean, all that, but see Paul and are inspired to preach the gospel. Think of how you and I are inspired by people who make sacrifices for greatness, right? I think of the Olympians. I'm not much of an athlete, but I have a ton of respect for people who push a body to that level. And whenever I read stories of the Olympians who get up, who make all kinds of sacrifices, who give up an easy life, who give up sleep, who get up the dark 30 in the morning, who give up sugar, can you imagine? Who give up fast food, who give up all sorts, who give up a career, who give up a decade of all in the pursuit of greatness. And every time I read a story, I'm inspired. I can get up an hour earlier. I can run a mile farther. I'm inspired to push forward. I think the exact same thing happened with the brothers and sisters in Rome. People get inspired. You know, Paul is willing to go to prison for the gospel. Gosh, why can't I? Paul's willing to die for the gospel. Why can't I? Now, the point is, the empire's agenda was to make a public example of Paul, to stand Paul up and say, listen, here's what happens to anybody with the audacity to stand up against Rome. Did that work? No, it backfired. Everybody goes, oh yeah? That's the worst you can do? Prison? Bring it. Let's go preach Jesus. Oh, that's the worst you can bring is death. You know what? Death's not all that bad because I believe in resurrection. Bring it. Let's go preach the royal announcement that Jesus is Lord. And Paul says, all that happened to me, down to prison, actually, opposite of what you think, has served to advance the gospel of Jesus. Now, it's not all roses, 15. It is true that some preach the king out of envy and rivalry, but others out of goodwill. The latter do so out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former preach the king out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, supposing that they can stir up trouble for me while I am in chains. Good news and bad news. The good news, hey, people are out on the streets of Rome preaching the gospel. The bad news, not all the people, but a contingent of the people are preaching the gospel for all the wrong reasons. Envy, rivalry, selfish ambition, who knows, money, sex, power, I have no idea. People who are brothers and sisters, as far as we know. People who are preaching the gospel straight up, right on, as far as we know, but who are marred and broken behind the scenes by envy and rivalry and are doing it in spite. Hey, Paul's in prison. Now's my chance to get ahead. Now's my, no more competition from Paul, right? Mr. I write the Bible. No more competition, right? Now's my chance to start a new church, to break off, to get followers, to whatever. And it's salt on the wound. And you would think, Paul right here would break down in tears, depressed, right in the dumps because of, gosh, people out there preaching the gospel for all sorts of ulterior motives and I'm shut up in prison. But no, not Paul. Keep going, 18. Paul says, what does it matter? The important thing is that in every way, whether from false motives or true, the king has preached. Because of this, I rejoice. Dude, you are crazy, right? Paul says, you know, the important thing, what really matters is that the king has preached. That is all over the place. That's happening. Right now, as we speak, that's happening. The king is preached. And you know what? I'm happy to celebrate that. Because of this, what does the text say? I what? Rejoice. There's that word again, my friends. Paul uses the word joy, or rejoice. Keep in mind, joy and rejoice come from the exact same Greek word. Joy is the noun, rejoice is the verb. Paul uses the word joy, or its cognate rejoice, 16 plus times in Philippians. That's a short letter. More than any of his other letters, joy is the undercurrent that cuts across all of Philippians. And where is Paul? In prison. Shut up. Beat down, on the out, in shame, about to stand trial. And you know what? Because of this, I rejoice. I mean, you just can't keep this guy, Paul, down. If I'm in prison, I mean, you put me in a Roman prison for 3 days. I'm on meds. I'm down in the dumps. I'm miserable. Instagram shots of my cell walls, you know, tweets of misery, you know. My faith erodes. I doubt God. Where is God? I have no fabric, but Paul, I mean, the dude is made from iron. You just can't keep this guy down. Paul says, right in smack dab in the middle of prison, because of this, I rejoice. Now, 16 plus times, right? Paul uses the word joy. Every time, and here's one example, every time Paul uses the word joy, you and I get to peek behind the curtain into Paul's life and see, I mean, here's a man who is filled with joy. And you and I get to peek and see how to live with that kind of joy that never goes away 24/7, that's not connected to circumstances per se. He's in prison. And you and I get to learn how to live filled with joy. On that note, here's one thought for today. To land the plane, one thought before we open up the tables. But don't get your hopes up. It's a long, drawn-out, complex thought. But it's one thought. I want to talk for a few minutes about what I call the redemptive edge. This passage is a prime example of how the God we worship in Jesus is able to take evil, and you fill in the blank there. For Paul, it's prison and persecution and beatings and in the end, death. You live in America. The odds are that's not your story. But you all bump up against evil, right? Cancer, your parents' divorce, unemployment, whatever, right? You fill in the blank. The God we worship in Jesus is able to take evil, cut into it with redemption, and dig out good. Because that's what God does. Now, please listen. Do not misunderstand me. I'm not saying that evil is somehow God's will or all part of God's plan. I do not buy that for 2 seconds. What happened to Paul was evil. Paul's incarceration was evil. Paul being in a Roman prison was no more God's will than Jews being in a Nazi concentration camp. It was horrific, it was hellish, it was demonic, it was wrong. The people preaching the king for all the wrong reasons. Was that God's will? No, flat out, that's wrong, that sin, judgment is coming for all that. But in a strange way, God was at work in that. And God was, yeah, at work in and through that. You know, I find that when followers of Jesus bump up against evil, and that will happen no matter who you are. I mean, my life has been easy for the most part compared to a whole bunch of you. I kind of feel like a hypocrite to speak of evil, right? But nobody gets out of life immune. Not one of you. You will all bump up against evil. You live in a war zone, right? You are going to get burned. Welcome to church. Happy you are here. But we all bump up against evil. Some of you, some more than others. Absolutely. But we all bump up against evil. And I find that followers of Jesus land on one of two sides. Some people, when that happens, whatever, you fill in the blank, death or cancer or persecution or prison or it falls apart or failure, whatever. Some people get angry at God, bitter at God, mad, shake the fist at heaven. God, why? And doubt comes in and rips out faith, and people turn away from God, turn away from the gospel, turn away from the church, turn away from Jesus, and walk away mad at the God they no longer believe in. Other people don't go down that path at all. Other people default to, you know what? God's in control. How many people say that? I hear that all the time. When was the last time you heard me say that? Never. You never hear me say that. But I know a bunch of people who default to, you know what, God's in control. It's all part of God's what? Plan. When was the last time I said that? I don't, people. I'm sorry. It's all part of God's plan. And I know there's a reason for my suffering. I hear that all the time. I know there's a purpose for my suffering. Now, I'm sure there are bits and pieces of truth in that. But as a general rule, it's no secret, I just don't buy that. And here's why. My beef with both sides it is really simple. Both sides blame God for the evil. Both sides put the onus of responsibility on the shoulders of God. And in my opinion, life, or what in theology is called providence, is far more complex. And yeah, I think there are times when the responsibility falls on the shoulders of God, absolutely. But that is not my default setting. Case study, I have a friend of mine I was with yesterday who's an architect. And a few months ago in the fall, he asked his girlfriend, "Will you marry me?" She says, "Yes." It's all glorious. 2 weeks later, he gets laid off. Now, anybody here unemployed like that? You don't have to put your hand up. That's okay. Sorry. You're like, "My life is bad enough. I'm sorry." And that's a serious, I get why that churns people up. You were made by God to work, and that does something to a man or to a woman. It's hard. I mean, I get that. And, you know, he's out of a job, and he's engaged to be married. What a horrific time, guys. Will you marry me if you will pay the rent, right? And really hard stuff. And, you know, let's take that study. I mean, what? Maybe that was God. Maybe that was God's will. Maybe that was all part of God's plan. Maybe there was a purpose for that. Maybe there was a reason for that. In fact, maybe it was. He just got a fabulous job, started on Monday at one of the best firms in town, right? After 6 long months. And maybe that was God's plan, maybe. Or maybe it was Satan. Maybe it was God, but not that God. Maybe it was another God at war with the Creator God. Maybe it was demonic. Maybe the enemy saw God at work in my friend's life and stepped in to sabotage God's grace in my friend. And maybe the response there is not to trust God as much as to fight with God against evil. And maybe it's not that at all. Maybe it was because of sin. Maybe my friend is a lousy employee. I don't think so, but he's not here right now. I can postulate, right? I mean, maybe he was late for work and on Facebook and reading his Bible when he should have been architecting houses. And, you know, I don't know. I don't think so. I think he's a vigorous, hardworking guy, but maybe it was my friend's sin. Maybe it was sin, but not my friend's sin. Maybe it was a coworker's sin. Maybe a coworker lied about my friend to get ahead, a manipulation, and it's brutal. And my friend was collateral damage. Or maybe it's not that. Maybe it's just life in a fallen world. The economy's in the tank, and it's not the right time of the century to be an architect. And it's just brutal, and it's slim pickings out there, and it's just hard. The company had to downsize, and my friend was new to the firm and had to go. And it was not God's will, per se, or God's plan. It's just life in a beautiful but cracked at the seams world. Or maybe it's a synthesis of two or three of the above. I have no idea. But my default setting is not to, hey, that was all part of God's plan. There's a reason, there's a purpose. My default setting is, listen, maybe that was demonic, maybe that was sin, maybe that was life in a fallen world, maybe that was God, but either way, the tomb is empty, my friend. The gospel hope is not that everything that happens to you is the will of God. The gospel hope is that no matter what happens to you, God is with you. God is right at your side. When you bump up against evil, God is right there with you. In your past, God was never far from you. In that moment of abuse, God was there, torn open with you. God's a suffering God with a suffering people. And the tomb is empty. And no matter what is in your path, you follow a God who is able to bring good out of evil, able to absolutely wipe away and turn anything into God's cosmic purposes for redemption. That is the gospel hope. I think of that line in Romans. You all know, because people quote it all the time, you know, we know that in all things, God works for the good. By the way, please never stop right there. I hear people quote the first half of that sentence. In my opinion, if you quote the first half of that sentence and you put a period after the word good, we know that in all things, God works for the good, I think that's heresy. By the way, that's where heresy comes from. It's when people take a verse out of the Bible and they ignore what was just said before and what was just said after. That's where heresy comes from. That I don't buy that at all. God works all things for good? What world are you? What universe are you in? That's not what Paul says. Paul says, we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him and have been called according to his purpose. Meaning for those who love God. Get the second half of that sentence. For those who are called according to his purpose, who wake up day after day and say, God, here's my life, all my brokenness, all my pains, all my hopes, all my dreams, my past, my present, my future, here And I unload onto your shoulders, have your way, not my will, God, but your will be done. And who follow Jesus day by day, at that moment, God is able to step into your life and work all things together for good. The evil in your life for good. The mistakes you made in your past that were not God's will, that were not part of God's plan, that were your fault. God is able to turn that into good. And that doesn't make it not evil. It's always evil. Abuse will always be evil. Divorce will always be evil. Pain and cancer and sickness and death will always be evil. But you worship a God who is able to take that evil that was not his will, not his heart, not God's plan for your life was you in Eden naked with God forever. How does that sound? Fabulous to me. That was God's plan. But you worship a God who's able to take you in the aftermath and the chaos and the violence of a broken world and who's able to reach in and rescue you and work for good in and through your life. That, my friends, is the gospel hope. It's what gets you up in the morning. It's not somehow trying to imagine that evil is good. That's Buddhism. That's not the gospel. It's trying to imagine how God is going to pick up the evil in your life. And somehow you worship a God who works for the good. Now, the majority of you already know that. Great, thank you for that rant, John Mark. But tell me something I don't already know. Well, here's the twist for me in the text. You know, the upside and the downside to my job is that I have to actually live what I talk about. And I have to work through the text before I get up here and yell at you every weekend. And you know, it was really rough for me to process in the last few days, but really healthy, was the realization that where there's a breakdown between myself and Paul, myself and the New Testament, myself and God, is that I don't think I define good in the exact same way as God. I think there's a difference. I define good when I read, we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him. I define good as for my happiness. Am I alone in that? I am, okay. you were not sleeping in. You were up praying and fasting and way more godly than I am. Okay. But I think Paul defines good as to advance the gospel. And there's a difference, would you agree? Because when I say, okay, God's at work for the good through the pain in my life, I think for my happiness. Paul thinks, yeah, but really it's to advance the gospel. You know, keep in mind, this entire passage is Paul's answer to the question, how are you? Next time I will be careful before I ask, right? And Paul goes into a tirade about the gospel and the praetorium and the brothers and the sisters and people who preach Christ for wrong reasons, but I rejoice. It's all the answer to the Philippians questions. Paul, how are you? Are you okay? Are you in good spirits? Are you alive? What's up? I mean, what's the status? How are you? And because you could ask Paul two, in my mind, separate questions. Paul, how are you? And Paul, how is the gospel? And you would get the exact same answer. Because Paul's life was so closely bound up in the gospel that to speak of Paul was to speak of the gospel. Paul was all about the gospel because Paul was all about Jesus. Paul's life was swallowed up in Jesus. Paul, how are you? Oh, the gospel's doing great. Thanks for asking. Paul, how are you? You know, people say that. How are you? Oh, I'm fine. I'm in prison, but I'm fine. Paul does not say, you know what? Really, prison has been for my good. You know, it's kind of a break. It's kind of a mini sabbatical. You know, I work really hard. And, you know, I'm used to being homeless, and it's kind of nice. I have a roof over my head, and I never have time to write. I mean, here I'm churning out letters all the time, right? No, not at all. That's not what Paul says. Paul says, you know, it's served to advance the gospel. Does Paul sound like a victim to you? No, not at all. Here's a dude shut up in prison and he is on top of the world. I think one of the reasons, in my opinion, is because Paul gets that your role in evil is, and your role in God's redemption, it is active, not passive. meaning you have a part to play. I think of Romans 8:28, those who are called according to his purpose, meaning you are called by God when you bump up against evil, not just to wait and see how God redeems your situation, but you are actually called to partner with God in the redemption of your situation. For example, I have a friend who I know who at a young age, his father abandoned the family. And real rough, tragic, and left, walk out the door, that type of deal. And then a few years later, a father figure came into his life, my friend's life, and kind of became a mentor, and the guy was a pastor at a church. And everything kind of turned around, was on the up and up, and then his mom had an affair with the pastor. What do you think that would do to a young guy? I think he was 12, 13, something. I mean, that tears you up. Now, the beauty is that my friend did not blame God. My friend did not say, I know there's a reason. I know there's a purpose for my mom's affair. No, not at all. That was evil. That was sin. That was brokenness. That was wrong. But my friend did not blame God. Instead, and my friend did not sit around and wait for redemption, although he believed that was God's what God does. My friend actually took an active role. I mean, a few years later, he wrote a book on the need for fathers in America. And then he started a nonprofit, and all the nonprofit does, and it's spreading like wildfire now all over the states, is connect father figures with boys who don't have a dad. And he took an active role to partner with God for redemption. You know, my friend Tom Cole was down here this morning. His daughter a few years ago was murdered by a drug dealer. Was that God's will?
No.
Absolutely not. Not the God I worship. Maybe another God's will, but not the Creator God's will. And he did not blame God. He did not get bitter. He instead went to the prison where the guy was shut up for life and shared the gospel with the man who murdered his daughter. And the man came to faith in Jesus. And now Tom gets to tell people his story. What has Jesus done in your life? Well, how do you top that, right? What has happened to you? You all have a story. Some of you are like me. Your life, for the most part, has been easy, but you're not immune. What has happened to you? The God you worship in Jesus is able to take that evil, and it's evil, and cut into it and dig out good, my friends. And if and when you get to the place where your happiness and the advancement of the gospel are one and the same thing, at that point, you will have set yourself up for 24/7 joy. Because your joy will no longer be connected to how much money you make, or whether you're married or single, or whether your marriage is going well or it's rough, or whether you're employed, or whether you get the promotion, because all that's icing on the cake, or it's not what... But that's not it. That's not joy for you, because your life is about the gospel of Jesus. You get there, you get joy. That, my friends, is the redemptive edge. Now, to wrap up, I want to walk you through an exercise. Underneath your seats, in theory, should be a white card. On the front, it says Philippians. On the back, there are three lines. Go ahead and take that card out. Clear off your lap. Get out a pen, if you have a pen. Or lipstick, or whatever. And I'm going to walk you... I don't have any lipstick, I'm sorry. I'm going to walk you through an exercise right here and right now. The top line says, in quotes, what has happened to me? Yeah, I think there are ushers with cards. If you don't have one, put your hand up. What has happened to me? And that's a quote from the text. I want you to write in, fill in right there. What has happened to you? What evil has happened to you? And write in my parents' divorce, or write in the collapse of my business, or write in my sickness, or write in, I mean, whatever, right? What evil has happened to you? And don't blame God for that evil. You know, I mean, who knows? It's complex. And the next line says the redemptive edge. And I want you to write in how God has used that evil for good. and how God has stepped in and cut into that with redemption and used it. And by good, I don't just mean for your happiness, but I mean to advance the gospel. How God has used that in a beautiful way. And then last line says, because of blank, I rejoice, that quote from Paul. I want you to write in what you are going to rejoice in this coming week. For Paul, you know, it was hey, the king has preached. People are out on the street, all sorts of screwed up motives, but you know what? The king is preached. Because of this, I rejoice. What is it for you? I mean, we all know it's Jesus, and that's not a trite answer. We're going to get to that in chapter 4. The ultimate source of joy is Jesus. But on a specific level, where is God at work in a redemptive way in your life? What are you going to rejoice in this coming week? And I want you to take that card, and I want you to stick that in your Bible or on your fridge or your wall or whatever. And I want you to rejoice this coming week. Take a few minutes. Clear your head. Close your eyes if you want. Listen for a second if you want to the Spirit of God and for the Spirit to deposit thoughts into your head. And go ahead right now and fill that out.